Sports 101.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
You know, we have to stay woke. Like, everybody needs to be woke.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars
and Nows.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host, Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. Boy, have we got breaking news all over the place. Number one, in Joe Biden's America, we now have an improvised explosive device that police was set off about an hour ago in Santa Maria, California, at the courthouse. Now, we'll get you details as they become available. As I said, it only happened about an hour ago. Thankfully, two people have been injured, but not with life-threatening injuries. Nobody has been killed, and the police say they have a person of interest in custody. But imagine the point where we've always heard about improvised explosive devices, IEDs, in places like the Middle East. But now we got them coming home to America. We'll get you details as they're available. As I said, no one has died in Santa Maria, California, where an improvised explosive device was apparently set off at the county courthouse in Santa Maria, California. Two people have suffered injuries, but thankfully neither of those has life-threatening injuries, and details as they become available. And then you've got this. State government in Oregon is now saying that if you make more than about $26 an hour and you have a beef with your employer because your employer shortchanged your paycheck, you are just flat out of luck. We actually have an agency called BOLI, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, that ordinarily, when I get a call from somebody who says, hey, my boss shorted my last paycheck, or my boss won't pay me the wages that I'm entitled to, I say, you call BOLI, even though I'm not the biggest fan of state government in any one of the Northwest states. But I will tell them, BOLI, or in the case of Washington State, Labor and Industries will go to bat for you. Now, BOLI now says they are going to hold hostage the wages of people who make more than about $26 an hour. And they say they will not go to bat for those workers who make $26 an hour or more. And that is most of the construction trades. It's an awful lot of the people who work at a living or work to make a living, and they have considerable skills and abilities. But this isn't doctors and lawyers and people like that. This is people who work for wages, and if they make more than $26 an hour, the labor commissioner, Christina Stevenson, and I would remind you that BOLI has a really corrupt kind of background in the last couple of years. You've got one former BOLI commissioner who's now a member of Congress and is being investigated for corrupt activities, Val Hoyle, because she was directing monies to some of the people who put money into her campaign. So you've got that kind of background. You've got the government of Governor Tina Kotek. And what did she do? She went to the state legislature, to the Senate Labor and Business Committee, and said, any workers making more than $52,710 an hour, that translates to $26 an hour or more, that you will not have your complaints answered by BOLI. And I want to tell you why I think this is so absolutely crazy. They are holding your wages hostage. They admit that the vast majority of cases, when somebody comes to BOLI and says, I got shortchanged on my paycheck, they say that they find in the majority of cases that they have a legitimate beef. And they go to the employer and they say, you are required under the law to pay this worker his or her wages, pay up, and they get the employers to pay up. Now, they say most of those complaints that they get are valid, and they are going to start ignoring the complaints from anybody who makes more than $26 an hour. So if you're listening to this right now, you've got a state government agency whose job is to investigate when you are being cheated. And the agency is saying, we are going to hold that hostage. We will not investigate those cases unless the state legislature gives them a, get this, 36% boost in their budget. So they're holding you hostage and telling the legislature, pay up or we're not going to help any of those people. And it also means they're not doing this based on how much wages are owed. So it literally means that if somebody making, say, minimum wage says, my boss shortchanged me by, say, 3 hours of pay. So in other words, they got shortchanged about $50. I'm not saying that's not a significant thing for somebody making minimum wage to get shortchanged by $50. But if, say, somebody working in the trades, people in the trades often make $35 or $40 an hour. Somebody walks in and says, hey, I got shortchanged for 100 hours of my work. My boss owes me $4,000. Boldly says, you make too much money. We're not going to do a damn thing for you. But if a kid walks in and says, hey, I make minimum wage and my boss shortchanged me $50, they're going to go to bat for them. You think there might be a political motive in all of that? Because I smell politics all over that. And to have a state agency not say, we're going to decide based on the size of the claim. If somebody walks in and says, hey, my boss owes me $1,000, whether they make $16 an hour or $60 an hour, we will go to bat for them. No, they're not going to do it based on how much they've been shortchanged. That might be the way that a police agency would say, we're going to investigate larcenies that are north of $1,000 or north of $2,000. That would be one way to sort out if you're short of resources. But Boley is claiming that even though they have a fairly large budget, I mean, they have a budget that's in the tens of millions of dollars. They have 149 people who work in that agency, but only 10 of them are investigators. And they're saying, we are not going to start investigations. They will begin dismissing all claims from workers who make more than $52,710 an hour. I think that is absolutely outrageous. And the fact that they're going to hold those people's wages hostage because they want a budget increase, they need to replace this woman just like they replaced Val Hoyle when she ran off to run for Congress. In any case, welcome to a Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And of course, you can always vote in our X poll. Now, this one, it has to do specifically with something coming out of Seattle, but you can imagine it just as easily applying elsewhere. The Seattle police have now said that they are not going to respond to home and business alarms. That includes break-in alarms, burglary alarms, robbery alarms, unless there is video, audio, an eyewitness, or somebody hits a panic button. If you have an alarm system, and let's say the police are notified that a house or a business has been broken into, if there is not video, audio, an eyewitness, or an actual person hitting the panic button, they are going to stop responding. Now, should the cops stop responding to home and business alarms without concrete evidence of a crime? I would answer that one no. You can answer any way you like. You'll find the X poll question every day at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. But this Boley story, this just really gets under my skin. The idea that a state agency effectively holds people hostage and says to the legislature, pay us more money or we're not helping those people out, that is outrageous. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, I think the time has come to talk bluntly about why Iran wants Donald Trump assassinated and why some American Democrats have helped to make that happen. What do we know about the facts on the ground? Trump took a tough stance against planet Earth's biggest sponsor of state terrorism. He drove Iran down to their last few rials by the time he left office. Joe Biden quickly reversed that, and today the mullahs have about $70 billion in the bank. Trump's return to the Oval Office, that's bad news for the biggest sponsor of state terrorism on Earth. The day before the first assassination attempt on Trump in July, our government arrested a man plotting another assassination attempt with Tehran's backing. He is now indicted, and he's being held in custody. We know America's Secret Service has failed miserably in its mission to protect Donald Trump from one plot and two men with guns. Well, yesterday, a unanimous U.S. Senate, that's both Republicans and Democrats, voted to boost Donald Trump's protection big time. They want to make it equivalent to the kind of protection that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris enjoy. And why? Because Trump's return to the White House, which appears more and more likely every day, means bad news. And Kamala Harris promises more moolah for the mullahs. Joe Biden has no good reason to reward Iran. And yet now we're on the verge of a full-blown war in the Middle East. Elections have consequences. Just remember that when you mark your ballots. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day from Jay Reagan. Lars, the FBI arrested the second assassin's son for having child pornography on his computer. What about all the stuff they found on Hunter Biden's laptop, which I would point out, the FBI had the laptop in its custody for about 1 year before the New York Post finally did that infamous story about the laptop from hell? Jay Reagan says somebody needs to answer that question. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to all the public officials who made this kind of condition happen. KGW, the NBC affiliate in Portland, reporting a homeless woman delivered a friend's baby on a tarp on a downtown Portland street for the second reported time this year. Portland Fire and Rescue responded to a birth in a downtown Portland homeless camp. According to the dispatch, the woman had fentanyl in her system. She was still in the hospital at last check. Imagine in any civilized country in the world, if you told them in America, some people give birth to babies on the downtown streets of a major city. In the case of Portland, the 23rd or 24th biggest city in America, and they're giving birth on a tarp on a downtown street. Imagine trying to explain then that America is somehow the shining light for the rest of the world to follow. Our best email so far today, but you can send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. Roger Harvey writes in, Lars, yesterday in the mail, I was surprised to get three letters addressed to my daughters about how easy it is to register to vote by filling out the enclosed form or scanning the barcode on the letter. Sign and date the form. You are registered. No ID required. The letter says records show they may not be registered to vote. My daughters have not lived here for more than 10 years. The letter came from an address in Austin, Texas. The return envelope was addressed to the Linn County Clerk Elections Office, Albany, Oregon. It looks like it'd be very easy for me to fill out these forms and then vote multiple times. If you're unaware of this and you want to know more about it, I'd be happy to scan it and send it to you. I enjoy your show. Thanks very much. Signed, Roger. Roger, thank you very much for the email. To your calls now. It's Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. Let's go to Joel in Tacoma. Joel, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. First-time caller. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to do it. What's on your mind?
So I just had a question. Maybe you have covered this. I try to listen to you as much as I can. But
thank you.
The second assassination attempt that they had stated that there was a letter or something that was sent out like a month prior
A month or 2 months, they're not quite sure, but in fact, most of the stories that we talked about earlier this week said it was a couple of months before the actual attempt.
Okay. And so I guess my question would be is, if I'm reading it or hearing it accurately, in the letter he had stated that he had failed the assassination attempt.
Yep.
So did he go there and intentionally mean to miss the shot?
I don't think so. And Joel
was going to miss it. I just haven't had that covered or any.
Joel, what I talked about the other day, and I think this is one of those you hear about people in the military writing letters like this. Basically, I'm going to put a letter in my pocket. If something happens to me, give the letter to my family. So it was I was thinking I was putting that interpretation on it, that when he dropped his letter off that was sealed up and put in a box and given to somebody, I assume it's somebody he knew as a friend or an acquaintance. And I don't know whether he said specifically, open up this box if you hear about me in the news, or open up this box if something ever happens to me, because whoever it is gave this letter to the FBI and the Secret Service for their investigation. Two agencies that, frankly, I don't trust at all these days. And if he said, here's this box, don't open it up unless you hear something has happened to me. Well, people might write letters like that for any number of reasons, not about assassination attempts. So his friend did not open the letter until after he heard about this man, Ruth, is his last name, being arrested and charged now with attempted assassination of President Trump. So in that case, he was probably anticipating, if I try and I fail, then open the letter. But he wasn't going to tell his friend, by the way, if you hear about an attempted assassination of a former president, open up the letter. He just said, you know, if you hear about me, the FBI has not been that specific. But Joel, that's what would explain the letter, is if he had dropped it off with a friend and say, if you ever hear about something happening to me, open up the letter and take a look at what's in it. And in it, he said he's sorry he failed. So you'd anticipate that if he had succeeded, his friend might still have opened up the letter, but found, oh, he actually killed somebody, and now I'm looking at this letter. But he also said, and I'll offer $150,000, which I don't think he had. There's no evidence that he had that kind of money. He was he'd actually begged for $5 when he said he was trying to recruit people to go and fight in Ukraine. But if he... He said, I'll give $150,000 reward to anybody who will finish the job, meaning assassinate President Trump. And why the FBI chose to publicize this, Joel, I can tell you, in almost any criminal investigation, if I ask the police, can I get some more details about anything involving this, they'll tell you, we'll tell you the name of the person we've arrested, we'll tell you the charges against them, we're not telling you anything else, we're in the middle of an investigation. Why the law enforcement agencies, FBI and Secret Service, chose to publicize this, it makes me think they want this to happen. And I'm going to stick to that. I think currently the FBI and the Secret Service look at Donald Trump as a threat to their existence, and they are helping to publicize and clear the way for people who've already come after Donald Trump. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. He does the work so you don't have to. Bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, we've got state and local agencies all over the place saying, we're not going to go to bat for you. You've got Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industry says, we're not going to investigate your wage claims if you make over $26 an hour. So think about that for a moment when you plan your vote this fall. And then in Seattle, you've got the police saying, yeah, we're going to stop responding to home and business alarms without concrete evidence of a crime. Video, audio, an eyewitness, or a person pushing a panic button. Otherwise, the police will not be coming. And then you've got other problems as well. You've got a city like Portland that always wants to talk about equity and diversity and talking about defending women against sexual assaults and all that. And yet it is seemingly allowing sex trafficking to run rampant through the city. And the folks who've written about it most recently are the folks at Willamette Week. And Aaron Mesh is the managing editor at Willamette Week. Aaron, welcome back to the program.
Lars, it's my pleasure to be here.
Why is it that wide-open sex trafficking is going on in the city of Portland and nothing much seems to be done about it?
Well, I mean, let's start by just, like, laying out the findings of our story. And we can start talking about how to apportion blame, which is plenty to go around. And I actually agree with the thrust of your argument you've made already. But first, let's just say that, like, in 2019, there were roughly 35 of what are known as illicit massage parlors. They are places that bill themselves as massage parlors. Your listeners will know them because they often have LED lights and big signs that say massage now. And you'll see them dotted around residential neighborhoods. Obviously, they do not offer only massages. Many of them also offer sexual release to the men who visit there. These are not like places that are licensed massage parlors, but are instead operating outside the law. And in many cases, the women who work there are being trafficked. Often they are Chinese nationals who are brought over to the U.S. under false pretenses by their traffickers, who then place them in towns where they don't know anyone, where they don't speak the language, and yep. where they perform sex acts on the Johns who take advantage of them, paying something like $80 for a quote-unquote massage. Now, like I said, there were about 35 of these places in 2019. There are now 114 of them operating inside Portland city limits, according to a nonprofit that watchdogs these businesses. So that's an extraordinary increase in the number of these businesses, and the speed of increase is about a compound year over year 25% increase each year, and that's almost triple the national rate of increase.
Okay, so you mentioned licensing. If they're required to be licensed and they're not, it would sound like a fairly easy thing, relatively easy, for a city that has laws that say you have to be licensed to do this, to walk in, say, show us your license. Oh, you don't have one? You are red tagged and shut down today. Can you help me understand from the story why that isn't happening right now?
Well, the massage board's a state regulator. They don't have the power to do anything on a law enforcement level or to shut anyone down. I do think there are places where that could happen, and those places are the Portland Police Bureau and the State Department of Justice. So both of them have taken what seemed to me to be a very passive approach to allowing these businesses to proliferate, and the State Massage Board, which is keenly aware of the number of massage parlors that are not massage parlors, has complained to, has said that it has tried to alert local law enforcement and hasn't been receptive. We asked Mayor Ted Wheeler, who oversees the police bureau and has for the entire time of this proliferation, to comment, and he declined to comment on this story, instead pointing us to the police bureau, which issued a statement that said roughly nothing.
Well, except here's the part I don't understand. So the state massage board has no authority, but if you have a business that is operating illegally in the city of Portland, I mean, even on ordinary things like building a building without a building permit, the city can go to that site, say there's construction going on here. You need a license, a permit to do it. You don't have it. You're red tagged. Is that, I mean, I understand there's the law enforcement approach that probably involves using decoys or stings to prove that the activity inside is going on illegally. But even if you approach it as just a business, you're required to have a state license, you don't, you're shut down. Does the city have authority to do that before or instead of going the route of trying to prove that you're engaging in some kind of prostitution activity?
Absolutely. So a great example would be the city of Scappoose, which has done so. So Scappoose passed an ordinance that requires inspections and applications for any massage business license with the City Hall of Scappoose. It makes a requirement that the owner appears in person at Scappoose's City Hall, submit to an interview, submit to a background check, provide proof that everyone working there is actually a licensed masseuse, In other words, all the kinds of things that if you are running a mobbed up trafficking business, you wouldn't want to jump through any of those hoops, and you certainly wouldn't want to have your face anywhere near a city commissioner. So those regulations make it very unpleasant for someone who's trying to run an exploitative business to move into town. Portland has done none of those things, which again says to me that the values that we espouse in this city are not being matched by the rules we put in place.
So as usual, the hypocrisy is thick. They say we believe in all these things. We'll have, you know, dinners and we'll have celebrations and we'll have days to mark, you know, we're against all this stuff. But where they actually have a chance to actually act on it and protect people, women in particular, they simply pass on the opportunity. And a little town like Scappoose goes out and does a better job than the city of Portlandia. And the mayor, who's a lame duck, and the attorney general, who's a lame duck, and the district attorney, who's a lame duck, have all decided they're not going to do anything about it either.
I don't have any objection to anything you just said. I think you've summarized the story quite nicely.
Wow. And is anything going to change this? And is it even an issue in the current race for city council or race for mayor of the city?
It certainly hasn't come up in any of the forums that I've seen for mayor in this city. I hope that what this story does is elevate this problem into the civic conversation to the degree that elected officials, either on the next city council or, for that matter, Ted Wheeler before his time is thankfully up, decide that they want to do something about this.
See, now you just engaged in an editorial comment, but you are the managing editor, so you're allowed to do that. I love that you agree with me on Ted Wheeler. I can't wait for him to be gone. I wish he was gone right now, and I don't have any personal enmity to the guy. I've talked to him any number of times. He doesn't come on the show very often, but if he were willing to submit to an interview, he's done two and I think 8 years, and he had agreed to do at least one a year. But then he discovered that we ask hard questions, and Ted Wheeler all of a sudden just said, no, I'm going to go back to being a trust fund kid, and I'm going to walk out of the mayor's office, and that's going to be that. But it really is sad, because there are lots of things I wish government would do, but these are things they're required to do. The law requires them to protect people, and especially people who are the most vulnerable. And now I don't want you to think I'm turning into a bleeding heart. I'm just saying there's an expectation, and when they don't fulfill the expectation, they just say, so what? We're moving on and going on to other things.
I'm going to tell all my friends that you secretly have a conscience.
I think all conservatives have a conscience. The sad thing is the liberals will always tell you about how much they're going to help you, but how much they actually do is an entirely different question. That is Aaron Mesh. You can find the story at WWeek.com, where he's the managing editor for Willamette Week. Coming up in a moment, should people who were wrongfully convicted and they appealed and won, should they get a big payday because of that, even if they're not innocent of the crime? No.
He has small town politics with big town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. We endeavor to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. Now, our ex-bull question today, should the police stop responding to home and business alarms without concrete evidence of a crime? And if you say, well, the alarm going off, that would be my first clue, but I'm not a police detective. No, the change in how Seattle police respond to security alarms, documented by our friends at Como TV News, could affect thousands of people who use alarm systems. In a letter, the Seattle police chief, interim police chief, I mean, Seattle almost has to have a permanent interim police chief. They never seem to have a permanent police chief. Sue Rahr notified security companies that starting October 1, next week, officers who will now only respond to calls from alarm companies if there is evidence a crime is happening, like video, audio, an eyewitness, or somebody hitting the panic button. The SPD says this change is because they're getting thousands of false alarms, and I'm aware of that problem, but the alarm companies say it could put people at risk. Yeah. could put people and property at risk. And as one more example, the blue line is very disappointing lately. I mean, I didn't like it when they were attacked by Antifa and BLM, and you had all these jokers running around saying all cops are bastards and defund the police and all that. But when the police themselves start saying, yeah, we're not going to help you out with that problem, they're going to lose public support very, very fast. Today's X Poll can be found at Lars Larson Show, and it's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go first to Mark in Beaverton. Hey, Mark, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I run a private investigations company, and I was hired by a client who leased a business space in downtown Tigard. He wanted to start a family store, him and his wife. And after he had signed the lease and started to look at the things he was going to change for the location, he found that there was a quote-unquote massage parlor next door or a couple doors down. And so he'd worked really hard one day, went down to get a massage, and discovered that they were offering something more than that. He was very upset. He came to me and said that he tried to get out of his lease from the owner, who was the same owner that owned the massage parlor, and the owner would not let him out of the lease. So we contacted Tigard Police Department. We told them we were going to go down there and do some undercover stings. We're going to bring covert cameras with us. We did so, and both times we were solicited for sex. We contacted back to the Tigard Police Department. They told us they were aware of the problem, but that they had bigger fish to fry.
Wow.
And the owner still refused to let my client out of the lease. And obviously he didn't feel comfortable moving forward with the family business in that type of location.
I mean, so what do you do at that point? I mean, it's a side issue, but do you sublease it to somebody else? And that's probably not allowed. So you're kind of stuck. And when the local police say, we're not going to do anything about it, we have bigger fish to fry. If you'd already brought them the information, they might have said, well, I'm willing to bet they would say there's a chain of custody issues. You're not law enforcement, et cetera. But if you've got the goods in the form of video that shows that you are being solicited, you'd think the very least they could do is go down there and make a presence. You know, if the police show up and they start asking the owner, hey, we've got video of some of the people in your business committing criminal acts, that you might be able to tamp down the business at the very least.
You sure like to think so.
And they just said, no, we got bigger things to do. What are these? I wonder what these bigger things are. Or is it just that they're saying we don't have the time or the officers to do the job?
He told me he was aware of the problem. He knew exactly the location that I was talking about. And I told him we were hoping to get some police involvement, and maybe that would make the owner rethink the situation a little bit more. If he was coming down, and maybe he would think, hey, if I get, you know, cancel this lease and get some of these problems out of my way. But it makes me think he's completely complicit if he has no problem with that type of business going on there.
Yeah, that's what it would make me think as well, because we expect the police to use everything they can. And one of the things in their, what is it called, the continuum of force, is the presence of police. If the police say, hey, we're going to start coming down and talking to you. When customers tell us they've been solicited, we're going to come and have a chat with you. Like Aaron Mesh mentioned from Willamette Week, there's no criminal in the world that wants to have a lot of police attention or government attention to their illicit business. And yet, apparently, they're willing to let this nonsense go on. Mark, thanks for the call and good luck. And I thank you for telling us about that information. Presented to the police, and the police say, not our problem. Seattle police say, alarm going off, not our problem. Bureau of Labor and Industries in Salem says, oh, your job cheated you out of your final paycheck. Well, you make over $26 an hour. Not our problem. If government keeps doing this, the public should react. And if they don't react to the polls, then that's a problem. Let's go to Kenny. Hey, Kenny, we're close to the break, but what's on your mind?
Hey, real quick, I was going to talk about Tapioca Joe at the UN. But going back to the Seattle police not responding, that effectively puts the security companies out of business, wouldn't you think?
I would think so. I mean, why would you have an alarm if you know the police aren't going to do anything? And look how it helps out Joe Biden. He can say why crime is down, because far fewer Americans are even bothering to report crime to the police, because they know the police have already said, we're not going to do anything about it. So why bother reporting it? And Joe Biden and Kamala Harris can run around and say, crime is down in America. Don't believe your lying eyes. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
You know, we have to stay woke. Like, everybody needs to be woke.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host, Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's my pleasure to be with you, and this is the Radio Northwest Network. I want to ask you a question. Do you think that Oregon could fairly quickly cut 90% of its fossil fuel use in Oregon? And you could extend this to Washington, because I don't think Jay Inslee's policies are remarkably different, and nor will, if Bob Ferguson gets in, will his policy be dramatically different. Let's hope that Ferguson does not get elected governor. That would be a foolish thing for voters to do. They should vote for Dave Reichert. But having said that, if you say 90%, how are we going to cut that much? Well, the question might appropriately be put to the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, which, as John Charles from Cascade Policy Institute points out, is holding its final public hearing on a plan to reduce carbon emissions, CO2, 90%. And John, welcome back to the program, by the way. How fast does DEQ think that it's going to get this done?
Well, they are wanting to have 90% reduction of emissions by 2050, and so that also that translates roughly into 90% reduction in consumption of fossil fuels by the same time period, and it's ridiculous, and even more important, it's not necessary. There is no problem. If you go on their website right now, their air quality website, it says in 1980, only 30% of Oregonians lived in clean air areas that met national health standards for air pollution. Today, all areas in Oregon meet these standards. Great. Take a victory lap and leave us alone. We won already.
I think you can probably tell that John is the president and CEO of the Cascade Policy Institute, which is a free market think tank, meaning leave us alone when possible. Have the government do only the job it needs to do. The other thing I'm curious about with this policy, their plan to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by 90%. Now, we always think, I mean, I guess somewhat egocentrically, people think 90% of fossil fuel use, and we relate it right to transportation, cars and trucks and even buses. But is this all CO2 emissions, including those from industry and those, let's say, from use of petrochemical fertilizers and things like that? Because both Oregon and Washington are major agriculture states, and if they want to cut CO2 emissions, are they only talking about gas and diesel? Or are they going to include all the other things like fertilizer and industrial things that produce CO2?
Well, natural gas, diesel, propane, gasoline, these are inputs to the transportation system, to manufacturing. This is the heart of the economy. And metaphorically speaking, this is DEQ putting its foot on the throat of the Oregon economy and just suffocating us. It's really unbelievable. In fact, I would say it's all-out war on the natural gas utilities. So if you're a Northwest Natural customer or Cascade or Avista, this is going to just skyrocket your rates. I mean, and the question is why? DEQ was never formed to take these actions. To me, they don't even have the legal authority to do it. It's obvious there was an end run around the fact that the legislature refused to give Kate Brown the authority to do this in 2019, which is the year the Senate Republicans walked out in protest of this exact same proposal.
God bless them.
So in 2020, she ordered her executive branch agencies to get through the executive action what they could not get legislatively. And that's where we are today. It continues to be an end run. And the whole thing, to me, is illegal and immoral.
And by the way, John, they seem to have stolen a page out of the playbook of Washington, D.C., where Congress rarely does any of this stuff because the Congress says, I don't want to vote for any of that stuff or against any of that stuff. I'll lose my seat in Congress. So they leave it up to the bureaucracy. Is this Kate Brown and now Tina Kotek saying, well, I can't get it done even in a Democrat-dominated state with every statewide office filled by a Democrat, majorities in both the House and the Senate, and sizable majorities on most public votes. She still says, I can't get it done, so I'll just tell the bureaucracy to do it out of sight and out of mind of most of the public.
Yes, Kate Brown, in her last year, 2020, in March, issued an executive order that affected Land Conservation and Development Commission, DEQ, other entities, and they all took their marching orders to enact new and expensive programs, including the California program to force everybody into an electric vehicle by 2035.
Yep.
And, you know, as far as Kate was concerned, this was her last go-around. She was going to take her PERS pension and retire after that point, and she just shoved all these multiple programs down our throats. And this particular one, the carbon rationing program, was invalidated by the courts a couple years later on sort of procedural grounds and is being rebooted now. And so we're at the end of the reboot process. There's a hearing tomorrow at 3:20 at DEQ in front of their five-person board of commissioners, and those commissioners are then expected to rubber stamp the program in November and restart it. And they all work for the current governor, and in my view, the current governor should do what she did with tolling in March, which is, even though tolling on I-5 and I-205 was directed by the legislature in 2017, back when she was a legislator, in 2023, she comes to her senses and said, no, it's not happening on my watch. And she should be just telling the commission, this was a Kate Brown thing. Well, Kate Brown's gone now. I'm in charge, and we're going to deep six this.
Okay, and do you think there's any likelihood that she will do that? Because it does sound sensible to do that. And what I worry about, John, is they put it on hold and say, we're just going to keep pushing back to get it done at some point. It'll only be on hold, but it will not be canceled.
Well, you know, it's hard to, you can't predict what a governor would do, but both Governor Kotek and Governor Hochul, and back in New York, she, just days before the New York City congestion pricing program was going to go into effect, she kneecapped that. It totally surprised me. So, you know, governors can, when they see the way things are going, even at the last minute, they can change things. And the DEQ reports to her, I think they've gone rogue. They are way beyond what they should be doing. And she can stop this if she wants, and I think she should.
Okay, give me your estimate. This is John Charles from Cascade Policy. If they were to actually implement this and say it was only by 2050, but it'll roll in between now and then, what would it do to the state of Oregon, to industry, to jobs, and to the population?
Well, it would begin to raise the price of everything because energy is the lifeblood. I mean, natural gas, gasoline, everybody who buys those things to transport or manufacture things, you would see prices go up. In some cases, businesses would shut down, and there's something that the DEQ refers to as industrial leakage. You would simply see companies fold up and move to other less regulated states and produce something there, and those emissions would then be the same, except that Oregonians would be deprived of jobs. I mean, DEQ knows that is possible and, in fact, likely. So you would just destroy wealth, destroy employment, and it'd be pointless.
Absolutely right. That is John Charles, President and CEO of the Cascade Policy Institute, Oregon DEQ, proposing to reduce carbon emissions, fuel use in Oregon by 90%. Back in a moment, we'll talk about
unwrapping the news so you don't have to. Back to the Lars Larson Show.
Look at where we are now. Just this morning, we learned that the economy created 190,000 jobs last month. All told, we've added 13.5 million jobs since I took office.
Now, that's Joe Biden bragging, but that was back when he was still running for re-election. But I got to tell you something. Kamala Harris has the same problem. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been bragging about how great the Bidenomics economy is. It actually sucks. But more than sucks, it's actually replacing American workers with foreign-born workers, many of them illegal aliens. Let me get into the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Of course, if you're a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the line. You get to go first. You just have to stick around for a few questions from me. If you disagree with my point of view, I'm glad to let you make your point, but I need to be able to ask you a few questions about, exactly how you got to that conclusion. I always share with my audience how I come to my conclusions. I like to cite my sources as well. Just consider the fact that Joe Biden's Customs and Border Protection estimates that by May of this year, at least 10 million, I know the real number is probably far more than that, but at least 10 million illegal aliens had come into America. And the question a lot of us have been asking from the get-go is, if you let 10 million people come into the country, and they are, most of them, not allowed to work a job unless their status is in some ways legalized, and Joe Biden has done a lot of that, granting humanitarian parole, granting asylum, granting refugee status, most of it doing it illegally, but he's been saying to them, come on into the country. We'll give you some money. We'll give you a bus ticket. We'll give you an airplane ticket. We'll give you a hotel room for a while. And then I think you're going to be on your own. Well, after 3.5 years of that nonsense and literally millions of illegal aliens flooding into every state in America. Now, a lot of these illegal aliens are selling drugs like fentanyl that is killing Americans in record numbers. A lot of those illegal aliens are trafficking in sex and pornography, and they're trafficking children and adult women. But one of the other things they're doing that takes gets less attention is the fact that they are taking away jobs from American citizens. Now, the idea of the great replacement theory gets disparaged all the time. But you tell me what it is. 2 months ago, we pointed out to you that about 1.5 million jobs had been filled in America and that about 800,000 native-born people, people born in the United States who are citizens of this country, they were out of jobs and about 800,000 illegal aliens had replaced them. So what's happening? Well, last week, we got a real confession. This one actually came from the Federal Reserve Chair, Jerome Powell. And what did he say? He admitted, and we don't have sound of him doing it, but it was in a document, immigration, so-called immigration, because coming in illegally is not immigration. It is illegal. It is against federal law. You're not allowed to come into the United States unless you do it legally. But immigration is pushing the unemployment rate higher. That's not Lars Larson saying that. That is Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. He says the illegal aliens enter the labor force and they look for jobs. Can most of them work legally? No, they cannot. But they get the jobs in any case. So the job creation numbers are relatively low, about 100,000 per month. Now, they had a bunch of inflated numbers last year. They were just revised down by about 800,000 jobs. In other words, the Biden administration was reporting much higher job added numbers, and then they had to say, oh, by the way, remember those numbers we've been telling you for the last 12 months? Well, we overshot the real number by about 800,000, and that means that unemployment right now is going up. Now, why is it going up? If we're adding all those jobs and we've recovered an awful lot of the jobs that were temporarily suspended during the pandemic, why is unemployment going up? Because you just added 10 million or more people to the population. And whether you like it or not, and whether they're working legally or not, they are going to get jobs. So you've got unemployment going up, the cost of living going up, housing in shortfall. You didn't think that you could bring 10 million people into a country that was already notoriously short of housing and have housing not get tighter than it's ever been. You've got crime going up, the cost of energy going up. And at least until this last week, interest rates were going up. But finally, Jerome Powell said, we've got to drop those interest rates by half a point. That is not going to change things dramatically. So continue, consider this. Jerome Powell said on job creation, it depends on the inflows. So if you're going to have millions of people come into the labor force and you're creating 100,000 jobs, you're going to see unemployment go up. Boy, that Powell, he knows how to do it diplomatically. He doesn't actually have to say migrant or immigrant. He doesn't have to say illegal alien. He doesn't have to say any of those words. He just says it's inflow. You've got inflow of people coming into the country, most of them coming in illegally, most of them without the legal capacity to work. And all of a sudden, all those new jobs, they get gobbled up by people who were not born in this country, people who are not legally present in this country. And guess what? They're coming into a situation that's already tough enough for Americans. You had unemployment running very low when Joe Biden took office. Now, he and some of his surrogates have told lies about that. Let me point out one of them. Joe Biden himself has said that unemployment was 16% when he became president. That is categorically and provably untrue. During the pandemic, in the year before Joe became president, the pandemic and the actions of government pushed unemployment to 16%. By the time Joe came into office, it had fallen from 16% or down to 6%. It had fallen and it was continuing to fall. In other words, if Joe Biden had just showed up at the Oval Office, checked into his brand new job, and then headed for the beach, we'd all be much better off because unemployment was already dropping. Now, Joe wants to claim that all of the jobs that came back after the pandemic are to his credit. They are not. They are merely jobs that were there, that were artificially shut down by the many shutdowns around America during the pandemic. And the minute you told businesses and factories you can go back to work, they cranked back up again, they hired back their workers, and they got back to business. But Joe wants to claim that's all because of what he did. It was already in motion before he got there. America's economy, no matter who was president in January, would have continued to recover. Only Joe Biden decided to do things that would crush the economy. And at the same time, because unemployment went from 1.4% to a peak of about 9% last year, it's now back down to where it's only about double the rate of inflation that it was when Joe Biden took over. So he's created conditions in which energy is expensive. He's created conditions in which interest rates have gone crazy. The day Joe Biden took office, and if you don't believe me, go back and look it up, mortgage rates were 2.65%. They are now north of 6%. In other words, they are more than double the rate that they were when Joe came in. Now, what does that affect? It affects business. It affects home construction. It affects home purchases. And now Joe Biden is going to have you replaced with a whole horde of illegal aliens, and he's pretty confident that all of those aliens are going to remember who let them in, who gave them the debit card, and who let them work, and that would be Joe Biden and his border czar, Kamala Harris. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland. Do you realize you can literally have Lars with you all day, every day? Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've always been proud of the fact that the United States has in its Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, as the number one, the right to free speech and free expression. And it always pleases me. I mean, I wish other countries had it. But when I see a country like Great Britain, where they'll arrest somebody for standing and silently praying next to an abortion clinic, and the police come along and arrest the woman for silent prayer. And I think, thank God for the First Amendment. Except now, the First Amendment has come under attack from our own government, like agencies like the FCC and characters like Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. So James Jernowski joins me now, who's a senior policy analyst in technology and innovation at Americans for Prosperity. Hey, James, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
Does the Biden-Harris or Harris-Biden administration, whichever one you want to call it, I'm not even sure who's in charge there. I'm thinking it's more likely Barack Obama. But should the administration be able to tell the federal government, we, the government, will decide who has a right to say what when it comes to election advertising? And if so, where do they get that authority?
Yeah, that's a great question, Lars. And honestly, I don't think that they have the authority that they think they're claiming, certainly with this FCC proposal that they're trying to push forward here. You know, when it comes to the regulation of political and issue ads, that jurisdiction largely falls with the Federal Election Commission, which has always gone and had the disclaimer requirements that they go and set out. And the FCC's responsibility here is much more narrowly defined. And really what that rule is trying to do is control and reduce the ability to leverage this promising technology and artificial intelligence in issue ads and in political ads. And really, it's a threat to the First Amendment, because at the core of the First Amendment is the freedom for using, you know, political speech, right? That was something that the founders were thinking about back then. And really, this proposal that's being taken up here by the FCC is something that really is an affront to that core fundamental civil liberty, which is why ourselves, the American Civil Liberties Union, and a whole bunch of our other organizations filed comments in opposition to this proposed rule by the commission here.
Now, what is it specifically they're trying to say you can or cannot do in issue or candidate advertising during an election?
Yeah, so they're trying to go and force a disclaimer, basically saying that if you're using AI-generated content within an advertisement in and of itself. And realistically, the problem with this proposal is the way that they're defining artificial intelligence, Lars, is so broad that it wouldn't be capturing just the ChatGPT stuff or any of the video-generated things that we've seen popping up around the internet, but it would cover even the most basic software editing tools that we use for video, for audio, etc., right? So, yes, while you might be thinking about ChatGPT, the way that you're defining this in your proposal here would cover Adobe Photoshop, right? And let's not pretend that simply using software to go and do this editing to make a candidate appear different or say something, whatever, is what's going and breaking political ads here. Political ads have always had their issues with truthfulness, but that's, again, that's protected underneath the First Amendment in many respects, right? So it's really problematic that the FCC is trying to go and put its thumb on the scale here to become the minister of truth when it comes to political advertising or issue advertising for that matter.
Well, and I also refuse to believe that the Harris-Biden administration would actually apply this rule evenly, that they wouldn't say, okay, we're shutting down Donald Trump's ads and all those other MAGA types, but we're not going to do as much to our own side, our own friends on the Democrat side of the aisle. I figured they'd use it politically, which is why the founders of the country said government can't interfere with free speech, not speech that it likes, not speech it doesn't like. You're not allowed to interfere with it. Doesn't it just exactly cross that line?
In my opinion, it absolutely does. And you're not wrong that there's going to be an imbalance in terms of how this gets applied, 100%. I'll note that, like, on the legislative front, when the Senate was looking at doing similar legislation that would actually outright ban the use of AI in political and issue ads, more broadly speaking, the genesis of that was actually tied to the RNC putting out an ad that was, you know, depicting at the time what a potential Biden second administration would look like, right? And all of a sudden, literally within a week, you had legislation getting produced in the House and then soon thereafter in the Senate that was targeting it, right? So make no mistake, they are certainly trying to go and target content that they think goes and, you know, basically makes them appear disfavorably to the general public, more broadly speaking. And I'm sorry, but the First Amendment just simply tells you that's not how that works.
Well, in fact, James, let me ask you this, because I try to think of this in real pedestrian terms, because that's where I am. I'm a simple guy. But if I can't draw a stick figure to save my life, but if I could, if I was a great artist and I drew a cartoon that made it look like Kamala Harris was standing down at the border, throwing the gates wide open for the illegals, they'd say, well, it's a cartoon. It's protected by the First Amendment. It doesn't have to depict what something that actually really happened. Kamala Harris doesn't go anywhere near the border, and for good reason. But if I do the same thing and ask an AI, can you make me a piece of video where a Kamala Harris-like figure, or even one that looks amazingly like her, is standing at the border throwing the gates open and letting illegals come in, or any one of a thousand other issues that are issues in this campaign. The cartoon would be allowed, even if it was very realistic. The AI version of it would not.
Yeah, that's the kind of risk that you run here. And even if you wanted to go and say that, all right, this is even a political ad. It's not even an issue ad. Maybe you made that entire cartoon as a parody to go and mock her position on that particular subject, right? Now the issue ends up being is that even if that was what your intention was, like that FCC rule or the legislation that was going on in the Senate would basically empower a situation where now you have to go and litigate parody in the courts. And yeah, it's like, okay, it's obviously parody or whatever, right? But the problem is that if you have to litigate it, that means that you're spending money on lawyers to go and defend it. And you know who that benefits? That benefits incumbents, that benefits larger operations and organizations that have the resources to do this. You know who that goes and hurts? It hurts people that are startups, that are challengers, that are smaller organizations that don't have the resources to go and use traditional advertising resources the way that these other groups can, right? So really, it actually goes in, you know, this same commission that pretends to care about small campaigns and you know, the minority groups that can go and stand to benefit from this technology are going to hurt those exact same communities with this proposal because they won't have the access to that technology.
Well, and James, I'll give you inside baseball an example from my show. I have a great group of producers, three of them, but we're not the biggest funded operation in the world. But Joel, one of my producers, will say, hey, there's this soundbite of Biden and he's saying something, you know, completely insane, but the audio is muddy. Or it's not very clear. And we never edit out of context. We never edit to change the meaning of what somebody is saying, but we want you to hear him, even if he's standing in front of a jet engine, which he is often, or under helicopter rotors. And he says, but there's these great programs on Adobe and other pieces of software. We can clean that up. If that software, and now it seems like almost every piece of software has some element of AI in it, that would be forbidden, even if all we're doing is making a soundbite more listenable, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the kind of risk that you run here, Lars, is that the most basic things, like all of a sudden you're using Adobe Photoshop to go and clean something up, or maybe, you know, by extension, if that's your opponent, right, you're going to make him look a little bit more menacing or something. Now, all of a sudden, that's going to be subject to litigation. I think, like, one of the things that was a problem in the proposal there, Lars, and you saw this both in the Senate legislation as well as with this SEC proposal, is that they want this notion of allowing for credible third parties to be able to go and flag this to, in this case, the broadcasters for the SEC. Proposal here, right? And the problem is who's the credible third party here? There's plenty of activist organizations that will go and basically inundate the broadcasters then with a bunch of complaints about, you know, perfectly legal AI generated ads, let's say, in theory, right? And that means that now those ads are going to get taken down out of abundance of caution because you don't want the regulatory scrutiny from the FCC. Like, you guys want your license, understandably so. Right. That means that they are going to weaponize that system to go and take down a perfectly legal advertisement. And that's the kind of risk that you run here by even empowering the FCC to have this kind of a rulemaking. Right. So really, it's really important that people are aware of what's at stake here.
Yeah, because now Joe Biden and Kamala Harris want to shut down free speech to benefit their own side of the aisle. That's James Chernowski, who's a senior policy analyst at Americans for Prosperity. Back in a moment, I'll get you your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Hey, it's Doc.
He's up before you are, weeding out the right from the wrong. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And this segment of the show is brought to you proudly by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. I have to mention this before I go to your calls. For the second time this year, the Portland Fire and Rescue Department, this is Portland, although I just got an email from a young lady in Seattle who says her daughter gave birth to two children while living on the streets. Portland Fire and Rescue, again from KGW, responded to a birth in a homeless camp. 7 months pregnant, 26 years old, the homeless woman gives birth on a tarp, one of those blue FEMA tarps in downtown Portland. It happened 6 p.m. last Saturday night. A call to 911, a 26-year-old woman in labor about to give birth in an orange tent on the corner of Harvey Milk Street and First Avenue. Now, imagine this. This sounds like something you'd hear about in a third world country. and yet the inaction and malfeasance of the political leadership of Oregon, Washington, Portland, Seattle, the state legislatures of both states have allowed the circumstances that created this monstrosity, this travesty. And I just had to mention it to you and ask you, what does it say about any city or any state or any region where babies are born on tarps on a downtown sidewalk? Let's go first to Wayne. Hey, Wayne, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind, sir?
Hi, Lars. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
When I hear these things about Oregon wanting to reduce emissions and all of this environmental stuff that we hear about, I want everybody to know that there, you don't have to take the word of what word the government is giving us. You can go on the internet and look up pie chart of atmospheric gas in our atmosphere.
Yep.
And there's a pie chart there, and if you imagine this, 72% of that pie chart is going to show it as nitrogen.
Yep.
23% is oxygen, and 5% is other, which some of that is argon.
Yep.
Of that total amount, between 0.04 and 0.08% is this dreaded CO2 we're so worried about. And of that 0.04 and 0.08%, 97% is naturally caused. So
yep.
It only leaves 3% of that we as humans are putting into the atmosphere. And if you look at that 3%, the United States is responsible for 30% of that 3%. So if you were looking at this pie chart, you're going to have a pretty small circle if you circle the amount of CO2 that's going to kill our world, supposedly. But the other thing that I read when I was looking at this, and this is amazing stuff to look at. The other thing that I read is that if we turned off all fossil fuel produced, you know,
in America,
we use, you know, vehicles, in America or Russia and China and all the other places, if you shut it all off, it will take about 50 years for that to gradually level off.
And it won't. And by the way, the temperature difference at the other end, at about 2100, the year 2100, will be relatively small. And add to that the fact that, Wayne, what they really want is they want to take human beings out. Because you remember that about a third of the stuff that produces CO2 in the atmosphere that is man-caused, not the stuff we breathe out, because all of us breathe out CO2 as well. But about a third of the use of natural gas and oil goes into transportation. And yet they always focus on transportation. About two-thirds of it goes into industrial uses and others. And one of the major others is making fertilizer. Fertilizer is largely made with natural gas and petrochemicals. If you want to turn off fossil fuel use in America, you're talking about turning off our food supply. And if you make that clear to people, they generally are not too enthused about it. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Dan. Hey, Dan, welcome to Wednesday. What's on your mind?
I was listening to your thing on the AI that they want to do. Well, how can they change the policy when you just remember the Chevron case where agencies are not allowed to make policies?
Well, you got a little past what they did. Because all the Supreme Court did, and it was significant, Dan, you're not wrong about that. But up to this year, when the Supreme Court effectively threw out the Chevron Doctrine, in layman's terms, because I'm not a lawyer, said if a federal agency does something that was not approved by the Congress, but they did it, and they exist because Congress created them, then the courts are going to assume the agency is right, unless you can show otherwise. And in that case, all they said was, we're no longer going to assume the agencies are right. So it means you can challenge what the EPA does, or you can challenge what other federal agencies do, and the courts will not automatically assume they're right. But it did not say agencies are not allowed to make the rules. Now, what Congress ought to do, And if we get a Republican House, Republican Senate, and Donald Trump in the White House, here's what I'd like to see them do. Tell every agency of government, you can make a rule, but you must bring it up to Capitol Hill, and we're going to vote on it. And if you don't get a majority vote in the House and a majority in the Senate and the signature of Donald John Trump, then that policy does not go through. I'd also like to see a sunset that says if the policy's been there 5 years and it doesn't get renewed by the people's representatives, then that policy no longer exists. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
You know, we have to stay woke. Like, everybody needs to be woke.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars
and Knowles.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host, Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and let's talk about taxes and what better thing to put on an American economy that is in bad shape. And if you're in the state of Oregon, what kind of prescription for bad news other than saying, why don't we have a very large corporate tax on gross receipts, not on how much money the company makes after expenses, but on their gross receipts. So whether the company is making money or losing money, they will be paying the tax. And then let's promise everybody in the state, man, woman, and child, everybody gets a big check. Now, the check may be somewhere between $800 and $1,600 a year. And you say, where's all that money going to come from? Well, it comes from those evil corporations. You know, the ones that we buy housing and food and energy from. And if logic tells you, well, aren't they just going to pass the costs along and we'll end up taking money out of one pocket and putting it in another? I have a feeling that's exactly what Senator Betsy Johnson, former Oregon State Senator and one-time candidate for governor, who joins me now. Betsy, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Now, did I miss anything in that description of what Measure 118 is when it goes to the ballot and voters get a chance to decide whether or not they want free money in the mail that is free money only because they've already paid it to a major corporation?
Oh, yeah, you missed a few things. Let me just go back and repeat something that you already said, though, and we'll take it from there.
Sure.
Just when you thought that you couldn't have anything stupider on the ballot than legalizing drugs with ballot measure 110, we get a group of California activists that are promoting a $6.8 billion, billion-dollar tax measure on Oregon's 24 statewide ballot. If approved, it's going to implement the largest tax increase in Oregon's history. It's going to hurt our economy, drive up costs for businesses and consumers at the worst possible time. What you forgot to mention is that there's no guarantee that the revenue is going to end up in the pockets of Oregonians. Politicians in Salem, by a simple majority, could vote and redirect the money someplace else that they want, or they could lower the threshold from $25 million down to $20, $15. And so it is the hidden bits of this tax that are so pernicious. And if you just go to the voters and say, hey, how'd you like some free money and we're going to make them evil corporations pay for it, the inclination is to say, sure. But what they don't know is that Oregonian businesses and by extension consumers are going to be forced to pay this at the grocery store, dining out, if you own a small business and you're in a supply chain where one of these corporations with over $25 million in revenue has to pay the tax, they're going to pass the costs on to you. And so it's conceivable by the time this tax gets to the poor old consumer, it could have been hit maybe 3, 4, 5 times, adding costs to everything, electricity, housing, medicine. There are no exceptions.
And by the way, the gross nature of it, I know that Oregon already has a sales tax called the CAT tax, which is a tax on gross revenues. But would you mind sharing with my audience, when they hear this is only going to hit companies that make that have more than $25 million a year in revenue, that sounds like a gigantic amount of money for an average person who hasn't run a business. But by my measure, that doesn't sound like a very big business at all.
No, it isn't. And take a small restaurant that's buying meat, for example, or dairy products from the Tillamook Creamery. It's easy to see how this would apply. Let me give you a really stark example.
Okay.
Let's assume that I grow trees. And so I cut the trees down. I pay the first tax. I send the trees to the mill to get turned into dimension lumber. I pay another 3%. Those logs go to a packaging company, another 3%. The logs then go, now the finished dimension lumber goes to a distributor, another 3%. Then it goes to Par Lumber before I come in and buy it. And now this 3% gross receipts tax has been applied 5 times. Our governor, who incidentally opposes ballot measure 118, wants more housing. What a rotten time to make that housing that much more expensive.
Well, and in fact, Betsy, let me ask you this, because one of the things that's just, it's been a burr under my saddle forever, is that America buys a gigantic amount of its dimensional lumber from overseas, or in the case of Canada, over a border. And I've never understood why a country with, I don't know, 180 million acres of trees would buy lumber from anybody. Because, you can think of lots of metaphors for it, but It's saying you have all these trees yourself, you could cut them down and log them, but you buy your lumber from the Canadians or from some other country. But in that case, the lumber that's coming in from those places might end up actually being cheaper than the lumber that's been stepped on 3 or 5 times by the state of Oregon, and it came from local forests and local mills to local retailers, but it got stepped on to the tune of 3%. Times 5 compounded, maybe 20% by the time you're done with it. And you might say, I'm not buying that Oregon lumber. I'll buy the Canadian stuff because it's cheaper.
Well, you're making a point. I want you to invite me back so I can talk about the maladroit management of the Department of Forestry.
Please.
But for the purpose that you just made, this is going to make Oregon businesses less competitive. So out-of-state farmers, manufacturers, and others will have an immediate advantage because this tax won't apply in their state. And if you want to believe the Oregon Legislative Revenue Office, Dr. Chris Alanak, has written a paper about this, the impact of the ballot measure 118. It could cost as many as 28,000 jobs. So there's 22 pages of Dr. Alanak, who's a PhD economist, holding forth on why this is a bad idea. It's about as entertaining as eating a Presto log. But what it says, and I'll give you the top line, is that the Legislative Revenue Office clearly spells out the dampening effect on economic growth, possible loss of jobs, reduction in wages and income, to say nothing of Oregon's reputational loss, because once again, we're doing it the Oregon way. First in the nation, untried, unproven, untested, and undoubtedly a failure. The same with ballot measure 110, because it is easy to get on the ballot in Oregon. These national interests want to try it out in Oregon, use us as a petri dish for bad social ideas. And then if it doesn't work out, the legislature, as they did with ballot measure 110, has to come in and clean up after it. This would be absolutely dreadful. And just remember, it's the prices for many everyday items and services that include food, medicine, clothing, housing. You go out to eat at a restaurant. Oh, and by the way, energy, at a time when our utilities are ramping up energy prices, now you get to pay an additional tax that'll get passed through from the energy companies right onto your bill, hurting those that can least afford it, seniors and families on fixed income. People should remember that old axiom that I'm sure our grandmother taught all of us. There's no such thing as free money.
Absolutely right. That's Betsy Johnson, former state senator, candidate for Oregon governor, talking about Measure 118. We will invite the folks behind Measure 118 on. We have before. They've never come on. I'd love to ask them some of these questions. Do you want a gross receipts tax on Oregon business with the promise of a free check in the mail for every man, woman, and child in the state of Oregon who's been here longer than 200 days? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Now
demand, wherever and whenever you want it. Get the podcasts all day, every day at LarsLarsen.com.
No threat will shake me. No enemy will intimidate me. And I have... I have never been more determined than I am today, and I will never back down in my fight to make America great again.
That is Donald Trump, and you really have to admire the man's chutzpah. I know you're going to say, Lars, you're biased. You're a Trump guy. You're going to vote for Trump. You voted for him before. All of that is absolutely true. But consider this. Two active assassination attempts on his life that have already happened. One man, separate from those two, is under indictment and sitting in federal custody, charged with conspiring with the Mad Mullahs of Tehran to try to assassinate Donald Trump. Five other assassination teams that national security has identified as being on American soil, three of them sponsored by foreign countries, two of them are domestic grown, and all of them aimed at taking the life of Donald Trump. And I'm going to tell you, as I've told you before, I think the Biden administration has tried to make it easier for somebody to take Donald Trump's life. And I think that is wrong. I think they ought to be called out on it. But I admire the fact that Donald Trump's willing to stand up and say, nothing is going to get in the way of my desire to make America great again. Welcome to the Lars Larsen Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, you can join it right here at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, I'm going to put you right in the front of the line. If you can persuade me somehow that the White House, the Biden and Harris administration are not trying to make it easier to assassinate Donald Trump, go right ahead and do it. But bring your facts and bring a certain amount of logic with you as well. I'll tell you that yesterday, the United States Senate, in one of its rare bipartisan moments, had a unanimous vote. All the Democrats and all the Republicans voted in favor of amping up the security around President Donald Trump, candidate for President of the United States, up to the level enjoyed by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Now, how often in the last few years, especially, have you seen all the Democrats and all the Republicans agree on anything at all? And yet this is because Donald Trump, I think, is right. That Iran is involved in the assassination attempts. The Biden administration itself has admitted that that is what's going on. That the Mad Mullahs of Tehran, the indictment against the man sitting in custody, not the guy from the golf course, not the man who died in Butler County, PA, trying to take the life and coming very close to taking the life of Donald Trump. No, the third guy. So we've had really three attempts, not two. But we know there are five more assassination teams, three of them foreign sponsored and two of them homegrown, all of them going after Donald Trump. And it took them all the way from the 13th of July when the first actual bullet flew through the air and nicked the ear of Donald Trump and came about a quarter inch from taking his life. We've had all that time go by, but now all the Democrats and all the Republicans in the Senate have said we have to increase security for this man. Now, what does Donald Trump think that Joe Biden ought to be doing about now? He actually made what I thought was a sensible suggestion of what Joe Biden could actually do to send a message to the Mad Mullahs of Tehran.
But if I were the president, I would inform the threatening country, in this case Iran, that if you do anything to harm this person, we are going to blow your largest cities and the country itself to smithereens. We're going to blow it to smithereens. You can't do that.
No, you can't do that. And yet, it seems as though the Biden administration does not seem to get the message. I mean, Joe Biden is saying all the right things. I mean, a couple of nights, one night after the attempt back in July, Joe Biden came out and asked everybody to cool down the rhetoric. And then he went right back to the same old messaging. We've got to put a bullseye on Donald Trump. And then consider this. Joe Biden's Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo. So she was on MSNBC's Morning Joe. And I want you to listen to what she had to say about Donald Trump. Now, they were talking about being a protector of women. What they're really going after him on is they don't like the fact that Donald Trump is pro-life. But listen to the way that the Commerce Secretary, who currently serves Joe Biden, talked about Donald Trump.
What he says is the opposite. It's just another lie. Like, how did we get here? Let's extinguish him for good. We have an answer. We have a remarkably talented candidate who is sincere, who's pragmatic, who's open. Let's just get it done.
Now, imagine that. This is after the second assassination attempt on President Trump's life. This woman goes on national television and say, let's just extinguish this man. Let's just get it done. And guess what just came out today? A brand new report about the massive failure of the Secret Service. Now, I know you probably think, well, we know the Secret Service failed because somebody got a bullet within a quarter of an inch of Donald Trump's head and actually nicked a piece of his ear. Well, according to the Senate Committee on Homeland Security, the Secret Service agent who was in charge of the drone in Butler County, PA. Remember, that was a question that we raised at the time? Because we heard fairly quickly after that assassination attempt, number one, that the Secret Service was not flying any drones, like a drone that might have spotted the young man on top of a roof with a rifle. And why didn't they have drones in the air? We couldn't get a straight answer out of the Secret Service. And then we found out that local law enforcement county in Butler County, PA, had actually offered the Secret Service, hey, we've got a drone. We've got somebody trained to fly the drone. How would you like us to put our drone in the air? And all of this was before the attempt on President Trump's life. And the Secret Service said, no, no, we don't need your drone. We've got our own, except they never put one in the air. Guess what Homeland Security Committee found out? The Secret Service agent who was responsible for flying the surveillance drone was so unfamiliar with the drone that he called a toll-free number for assistance in how to fly the darn thing. And what they found out, and they wrote this in a report released this morning, said that that agent, who is expected to fly a drone over a presidential or a candidate appearance of the former president of the United States, had 1 hour of informal training with the drone. I mean, I don't know how they do things at the Secret Service these days. I've had friends who worked for the agency before. But in this case, we've heard before that Homeland Security had to offer them a bunch of personnel, and that the personnel from Homeland Security had to take a 2-hour webinar online that turned them in from being Homeland Security into being a Secret Service agent. So what do? Hey, let's go out in the backyard and I'll show you how to fly the drone and do that for an hour. And that's the person who's supposed to be in charge of having the drone over a scene to make sure that nothing happens like what did happen on July the 13th in Butler County, PA. You've got a real mess here. And even the Washington Post wrote about the fact that the Homeland Security Secretary, the impeached Alejandro Mayorkas, had lied when he was asked, have you denied additional protection that has been asked for by the Trump team or the Secret Service team protecting him? He said no. Well, guess what? The assertion that a member of the former president's security team requested additional security is absolutely false. Only the Washington Post found out the agency had learned of new information indicating the agency's headquarters did, in fact, deny additional requests for security. And all of that came before the attempt number one, before attempt number two, and before the man was taken into custody and indicted for conspiring with Iran to assassinate the former president of the United States. The Biden administration is trying to get this man killed. I just hope God protects him. Back in a moment, I'll get to your calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Snowflakes. Yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment. Now, if I said by every conceivable measure, former President Donald Trump should be 10 points up, but he's not, he'd say, Lars, we already know your opinion. Except I didn't write that. That was actually in War Notes from our friend Leland Vittard, who joins us now. I like the stuff he writes in War Notes. He is, of course, the host of On Balance and chief Washington anchor for News Nation. Leland, welcome back.
Well, with an introduction like that, I'll come every day.
Well, we'd be glad to have you, except I've got to talk as well. Tell me this.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate it.
I want people to subscribe to this because I get a lot of good.
I think what we've picked up on is because by every conceivable measure, Donald Trump should be 10 points ahead. And we're pulling that from the Gallup polling that shows, for example, the first time in now 20 years, the plurality of Americans identifying as Republicans over Democrats. Yep. Republicans have a lead in the latest polling on every issue that matters. Americans' opinions of which political party is better able to keep the U.S. prosperous, Republicans lead by 6 points. There's no metric in terms of the issues that matter that Gallup polls in which Kamala Harris or Democrats has an advantage. So now you say, okay, so why is Donald Trump not farther ahead? And that's, I think, the issue for Donald Trump supporters to talk about, because if Donald Trump loses 41 days from now, it will be because of Donald Trump, not because of Kamala Harris.
Except, let me ask you this. I know that every time somebody doesn't like a poll, they just say, well, the poll is bad. But I'm wondering whether or not the polls have a particular, peculiar reason this cycle for not reading accurately, because I think we all know people who will tell their friends and family, I'm doing this, because they understand that they would, their friends and family would think less of them if they said otherwise. Except usually in politics, you could say, I'm for this or I'm for that, and nobody thinks badly. These days, Donald Trump has been so vilified by the other side and by the mainstream media, other than News Nation, that I bet there have to be at least a sizable number of people who are telling all their union buddies or their coworkers or their family, yeah, I'm voting for Kamala. It'll be great to vote for somebody who has no capability, but she's, a person of color and a female, so I'll vote for that. While privately they're saying, when I mark that ballot, I'm marking that for Trump out of self-interest, and they're not going to share their information in a way that is unique to this election in particular. Is that possible?
Well, anything's possible. The sun may rise in the west tomorrow. But you are on to something, right? Which is that polling over the past two cycles each time has undercounted Donald Trump. I don't buy that pollsters are biased. Pollsters want to get things right because that's how they can make money. That's how they end up getting more polling. That's how they end up getting private polling and corporate polling and all these other things that they do that they want to make money. So they don't throw it intentionally. But there is a bias of people who are silent Trump supporters, number one. And I'll give you something, number two. Polling is based on models, and we don't know right now how the turnout is going to look, especially in places like Western Pennsylvania, because when after the 2016 miss, everyone redid the turnout models and tried to put in more white working class men who showed up only to vote for Donald Trump, didn't show up in 2018, didn't show up in 2022. They got the wrong white working class men, so they missed it again. So they've tried to tweak it again this time around. But the private polling, you know, Trump's polling and Harris polling do both show this as a much tighter race than the public polling does.
Now, let me ask about another issue that I know you've been on top of, and that is Donald Trump was impeached but then acquitted by the Senate for collusion with Ukraine. And I always like to remind people, what were they impeaching him for, allegedly colluding on? And that was, he was asking Ukraine, I think there are Americans who are engaging in corrupt activities in your country and like you to investigate them. As it turns out, we now know that there were some Americans from the Biden crime family who were engaged in corrupt activities in Ukraine, possibly reaching all the way, I think certainly reaching all the way back to Joe Biden. But now we've got the Democrats, the same people who impeached Trump for Ukraine collusion. And what do? You fly Zelensky over to America, and then you run him around the country where he gives statements about how bad Donald Trump is and how good it would be to continue on the Biden legacy. It seems to me that they're doing the same thing, and here you can actually connect the dollars, that Zelensky gets rich, Ukraine gets billions of dollars, Americans get nothing much out of it, and they get to use Zelensky as a campaigner, And that's, to me, foreign interference in elections right out in front of God and everybody.
Well, a couple of things can be true at once. I think you are right to point out that using a foreign head of state that the U.S., in particular this administration, is giving tens of billions of dollars to as a campaign prop, and having President Zelensky show up in Pennsylvania at a munitions factory with Josh Shapiro, who's one of Kamala Harris's key surrogates, and basically say, be patriotic and vote for Ukraine, i.e. vote for Harris. That seems, to your point, way beyond coming to the United States to meet with heads of state, on and on and on. Mike Johnson, I'm sure you saw this, the president, the Speaker of the House, called on the Ukrainian president to fire the Ukraine's ambassador to the United States for organizing the visit and for doing this. So I think you're right to point all of this out. Two rights, you know, two wrongs don't make a right, and two rights don't make a wrong. You said we don't get anything from it. To my mind, and we're in danger of this, I think, more so in the Middle East, but when the United States pulls back from being the beacon and supporter of democracy, it is a bad thing for the world.
Now, hold on. Leland, I got to push back on you. The democracy we're supporting is the one that's outlawing churches and shutting down media outlets? Is that the democracy you're referring to?
I am saying that when the United States steps back and allows a dictator, in this case Vladimir Putin, or if it's the Ayatollah, to run roughshod over our allies or people or countries that have stood with us, it is bad for America. I spent 4 years in the Middle East. I can say lots of things about how Israel at times is undemocratic. Or flirts with the lines of democracy and freedom of speech and freedom of religion and equal treatment under the law and their behavior, which at times is abhorrent. But you stand with your friends and you help your friends stand up to bullies. That's what Ronald Reagan said. He, you know, not every country Reagan supported in standing up to the Soviets was perfect, but you stood up to them because you stand up to them overseas, so we don't have to stand up to them at home.
Well, I would like sometime to have a longer conversation with you about why Joe Biden watched Putin put troops on the border of Ukraine for a full year and then effectively invited him when a reporter said, well, what if he invades? And he said, well, if it's a small invasion, you know, we might have to object to it strongly and maybe send a letter or whatever. He didn't exactly push back. And it was almost as though he wanted the invasion to happen for political reasons that I think trace all the way back to the Maidan Revolution and to Crimea and a lot of other things about plebiscites that were held in Ukraine and about whether or not Ukraine is really acting like a democratic country or its own kind of flavor of dictatorship. But we'll have to save that for another day. That's Leland Vittard, host of On Balance on News Nation, and also the chief Washington anchor for News Nation. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Silver people. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a Wednesday, and it's the honestly provocative talk provided by the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. Our X poll today: should cops stop responding to home and business alarms without concrete evidence of a crime? Seattle police have announced that starting October 1st, officers will only respond to calls from alarm companies if there is evidence of a crime. And what they mean by that, they say, video, audio, and eyewitness to the crime happening or somebody hitting a panic button. Otherwise, they're not coming. should the cops stop responding to home and business alarms without concrete evidence of a crime? I'd say no to that. You can vote any way you like. You'll find the daily question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday, I ask you this. Should school districts, and in this case, I was talking about Seattle, because they had initially proposed to close 21 unnecessary elementary schools. The neighbors and the people in the neighborhoods around those schools objected, including parents of children who attend those schools, saying, we don't want our kids consolidated into a smaller number. Smaller number of buildings. So I said, should school districts close empty buildings, so save the resources for actually educating the kids, or keep them open, mostly empty, or one-third empty, to make the neighborhoods happy? 95% of you voted for close. Only 5% said keep those empty buildings open. On that note, let's go to Bellingham. Tyson's on the line. Hey, Tyson, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Thanks for having me, Lars. I you noticed bet. A few segments back you guys were talking about the massage parlors, but, you know, it's not a problem strictly for the Pacific Northwest. It's from corner to corner. And when you have billionaires like Robert Kraft frequenting those places, then it's a big problem. Robert Kraft got caught, you know, he's the owner of the Patriots.
Yeah, he got, a couple of years ago. But I don't want to focus on a problem just because one guy, because if one person was frequenting massage parlors, it would, you know, it wouldn't be a problem, but it wouldn't be a big problem. But these places only exist because there is a market. You've created the product and then you sell it to a marketplace. And apparently there are thousands or hundreds of thousands of people use them. My objection,
there
and
are,
you're right,
when billionaires
if we could,
like Robert Kraft use them, it's even more of a problem.
OK, it, you have a particular problem with Robert Kraft. I have a problem with anybody who frequents massage parlors for sexual favors that they buy. But here's the biggest objection I have, Tyson. They have licensing for these things, and you've got government agencies that have the power to shut them down if they choose to. And when they choose not to, my bigger problem is with government saying, we could shut them down, we're going to choose not to. The people who frequent them, I don't know how you control that.
Well, why not make an example out of that person?
Out of the dead guy?
Yeah, out of Robert Kraft. Why not make an example out of him? Because it's
how does that solve the problem? If you can persuade me how that solves the problem, so you take one guy and you prosecute him to the end of the day, and chances are he gets a malicious mischief.
It's just like the people who employ illegal immigrants. The illegal immigrants are the ones who are always hung up, but never the billionaires who support them.
Actually, I think you're misreading that one as well, because prosecuting those cases is incredibly time consuming and there's an easier way to get it done. Do you understand that?
No.
You know how to get it done?
No.
Yeah, you know how to
prosecute the people who are making the money.
No, because Tyson, are you an employer?
No, I'm not.
Okay. If you were, if you were and you hired a guy, and he doesn't speak English, he speaks Spanish or Guatemalan or whatever, and the government came to you and said, Tyson, you hired that guy, we're going to prosecute you. Do you know what they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in court? They have to prove.
Didn't do my due diligence?
No. Your due diligence is show me your ID and fill out this I-9 form. And they say, well, you should have investigated his documents. No. That is not one of the obligations of the law. They have to prove in court that you knowingly hired an illegal alien. Now, Tyson, let's say you start a new business tomorrow. You go out and you deliberately hire an illegal alien. And then somebody comes to you and says, you knowingly hired that. They might be able to prove it if you told all your friends, I'm going to go down and find the first illegal alien who can show me he's an illegal alien. Other than that, how to prove that a person knowingly hired an illegal alien, which is why the prosecutions usually take years. They take a tremendous amount of resources. Tyson, here's the way to do it. If Donald Trump, and I don't know that this is his plan, he's talked about deportation, but there was actually a bill before the Congress almost 20 years ago. And here's what it says. Very simple. It says, if you're a business, Seattle, Portland, wherever, and you hire a workforce, when you submit your taxes, you gross, say, $1 million, and you say, but I paid $500,000 of it in salaries to my 10 employees. and the IRS says you submit with those name, DOB, and Social Security. If they're not legal workers, you can't deduct their wages. The company that does that and hires illegal aliens will find out they owe $125,000 or $200,000 in additional taxes. The minute you make that the law, every single company that has illegal aliens has an incentive to e-verify, which is free of charge. The taxpayers pay for it. You could have every company in America immediately e-verify and dismiss every single illegal alien on their payroll. And it would start to happen the minute the law became a law, before it even went into effect. Go the prosecution route. It is going to be slow and ineffective. Go the IRS route. It'll happen right now. So go for the solution that actually works.
The Lars Larson Show.